This podcast of Word of Mouth is supported in part by Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England. Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine, information at doucetsurvey.com.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The fingerprint used to be law enforcement's smoking gun. Find one on a murder weapon, and you've got your suspect. Next came DNA evidence, forensic technology that has since put thousands behind bars, and in some cases, freed inmates wrongfully convicted. Now researchers are studying another biomarker that may be able to tell us even more about a crime scene, bacterial signatures. Jack Gilbert is an environmental microbiologist and team leader at Argonne National Laboratory and lead author of a paper exploring microbiomes in our homes and apartments. Jack, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you very much. Lovely to be here.
The reason fingerprints and DNA have been so useful for law enforcement is they're unique to whoever leaves them. How unique is a person's bacterial signature?
Your bacterial signature is 100% unique to you. Even genetically identical twins have very different microbial signatures in their body. And that's because we all experience different interactions with the world from the moment we're born until the moment we get to the current state where we are. So your microbial diversity is shaped by those interactions. And so we none of us live the same life as another person. So we develop a different microbial signature.
But our interactions also change over time. Can a person's bacterial signature also change? You know, will my microbiome be the same 10 or 15 years from now?
Well, think of your body as an ecosystem, like a tropical rainforest or a swamp or a desert, no matter what you want to look at. It takes a while to establish that ecosystem, and once it establishes, it's quite stable. And our microbial ecosystem stabilizes by the time we're 2 years old. And then it remains quite stable throughout life. It has blips around adolescence and later in life. But on the whole, it's actually reasonably stable. It does vary slightly. But unless you have a dramatic shock to your body, such as dramatic surgery or lots of antibiotic use or radiotherapy or something which really pushes the ecosystem outside of its comfort limits, it won't change.
How do you even see it? I mean, anyone who's watched a crime show has seen detectives dusting for fingerprints. What do you need to be able to see a person's microbial trail?
Well, you can't see it at the scene. What we do is we take a Q-tip. A sterile Q-tip, and we swab some of the microbial signature off different surfaces in a space. And then we take the DNA from those bacterial cells that we've acquired, and we sequence those using genomic sequencing, much the same way as we do with the human genome. And that genomic sequencing tells us which bacteria are there and in what proportions. And it's those two points, the composition of the microbiome and the proportions of the composition of the microbiome, that we use to identify which person they came from.
What kind of details about a crime scene might you be able to read through a bacteria?
Well, if you think about a fingerprint, you can identify whether a person was there or not there based on the presence or absence of their fingerprint on that space. Genetic evidence is similar. It tells you that the person was there or not there. But microbial evidence has a number of interesting new information twitches inside it. So I can identify, because microbes are living organisms, the time since that person interacted with that space. So, you know, we believe at the moment it's about 72 hours after a person has interacted with the space that the signature starts to decay to the point where we can't identify it. But within that 72-hour window, we can see a lot about when they were last there and potentially even who they were interacting with and maybe even what they were doing for a job or where they lived in, say, the United States. Because our microbiome is shaped by our geography and by the work we do and by who we live and talk to and work with.
So it's very different than hair or sloughed off skin.
Yeah, it's a dynamic marker. shaped by our diversity, not by our genetics. And so, you know, our diverse interactions, our lifestyles shape that microbiome. And so our lifestyle is almost imprinted on that microbiome. So when you leave it behind, you leave behind a lot more information about who you are and what you do than you do with just genetic signatures.
But somebody could come and vacuum away hair or sloughed off skin. Could someone come with a, you know, bottle of bleach and wipe out the microbiome?
They could. Well, your microbiome's inside you.
Your bacterial signature?
Yeah, they could do on surfaces, absolutely. The same as wearing a pair of gloves. Gloves could eradicate a signature from your fingerprints. But interestingly, unless a person was wearing a biohazard suit, they couldn't eradicate everything about the signature they left behind. It's very hard to eradicate all microbial life from a building or a space. And if you have a section of your skin showing, you will be sloughing bacteria into the environment. You can see this perfectly with spaceships. When we try and prep spaceships to send them to Mars, we try and sterilize them, but we've never been quite successful at doing that 100%.
Fingerprints and forensic technology have made it possible to trace crime scenes in a number of different cases. We'll add to that a new biomarker, bacterial signatures. Each person has their own, and Jack Gilbert is among those who is researching how personal microbiomes could be used to solve crimes and solve other big problems. Is your lab working currently with law enforcement to see how far you can go with bacterial evidence for crime scenes?
Yeah, we're in the nascent part of this research, but we are working with a number of law enforcement agencies in different states trying to identify if this technology could help them to develop another line of evidence, say on a corpse or even in a room. And so we're exploring how our microbial fingerprint decays after it's been deposited on different surface materials like wood and carpet and floor or clothing or even skin. And that's really helping us to pinpoint the valid usefulness of this technology.
Well, we know now that DNA evidence is not foolproof. It ages, for one thing. It can be misidentified, entering it into a computer. Is there a danger in seeing forensic technology as a slam dunk?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, forensic technology is only as good as the probability estimates that you want to apply to it. I know that sounds complicated, but everything is statistics. Two individual people can have a unique genetic signature, hence identical twins. And what we do when we look at a genetic signature is we apply a probability that it came from that person, i.e. it would be highly improbable that anybody else could have deposited that signature.
So
it's not a 100% biomarker.
But you would say, I mean, you've got somebody sitting there on the stand, you've got bacterial evidence connecting them to a crime scene. Is that enough for a conviction in your mind?
In and of itself, I would not rely on it right now. But absolutely, in the future, along with other lines of evidence, it could be incredibly valuable in telling us a lot more about who that person was that was interacting with that space, and then potentially helping us to find that person. So the person we put on the stand would have a significantly higher probability of being the person who committed the crime.
So in the future, maybe along with a mugshot, fingerprints, we might have bacterial markers that would be associated with people who've been arrested for crimes, and they would be on record.
Yeah, maybe even environmental microbial fingerprints of soil and water and environments such as homes around the country. So that if we found a microbial fingerprint, we could say, well, this person looks like they grew up and currently live around around Iowa, or maybe even around Boston. We're trying to determine the particular efficiency of identifying that biogeographic signal, but it's looking very important.
So we can imagine this technology being used in law enforcement. Other positive benefits of your research on microbiomes and how they might change our daily lives?
Well, absolutely. You're born essentially sterile, although even that hypothesis may be incorrect. But let's take for assumption that you're born sterile, and then you're forced into this world. And your microbiome is one of your first lines of defense against disease. And it also helps to shape your immune system and your physiological and neurological development. So our hope is that by examining how our indoor space, our homes and our cities and our cottages in the country, we may be able to generate healthier environments that can lead to the development of healthier children. So eradicating asthma and allergies, maybe even conditions like autism and Alzheimer's. So we're exploring how the microbiome shapes our health.
Really big, interesting stuff. Jack Gilbert, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jack Gilbert is an environmental microbiologist and team leader at Argonne National Laboratory. You can find much more on his work with microbiomes at wordofmouthradio.org. Even if you've never seen a Thai kickboxing match, you've probably heard that the fights can be sometimes brutal. Well, what you might see on television pales in comparison to the sport practiced in its country of origin. Up next, we're going to talk to a reporter who landed in the seedy and violent underworld of Bangkok's Muay Thai kickboxing scene.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In 1989, Thai kickboxing hit America's radar with a reverse roundhouse kick.
Take your bag and leave my house.
What's going on?
You don't want training.
Hey, you want me to break my leg?
Your brother. Remember?
That is a young and very fit Jean-Claude Van Damme seeking revenge in the 1989 film Kickboxer. But as dramatic and intense as the film's final showdown may have been, it does not hold a candle to the realities of the Muay Thai kickboxing scene in Thailand, as British journalist Alexander Reynolds discovered when he first entered the Rompo Muay Thai gym in Bangkok a decade ago. Alexander wrote about his experiences as a professional kickboxer in Thailand in an article for Vice called The Seedy Underworld of Muay Thai Boxing. And Alexander Reynolds, great to have you back with us on Word of Mouth.
Ah, kon sa bari mai kap. That's hello in Thai.
Well, thank you so much for translating. There's a lot that gets translated in this, especially, you know, your motivation for becoming a Thai kickboxer. How did you even wind up kickboxing in Thailand in the first place?
Well, my wife was a civil servant. She worked for the British government and we got posted there. And I couldn't believe my lucky stars because I'd actually been a Thai boxer ever since I was 19, learning the game in the grimy gyms of London's East End and rainy Manchester.
You mentioned the seedy gyms where you trained initially, the Rompo Gym in Bangkok. Tell us about that one.
Well, we were billeted on a road in central Bangkok. And as luck would have it, the local Thai boxing gym was the gym to go to if you were a Nak Muay Farang, a foreign Thai boxer. And the promoter there was a chap called Mr. Peck. Now, I didn't know this, but the gym was also rumored to be the mafia gym. So I went down there and I signed up and pretty soon I was fighting on the bill with the rest of the chaps.
How did you discover the mafia connection at the gym?
It was quite subtle, really, because it's something you don't really notice at first. But then when you've got all of these sort of fat bellies and these oily hustlers coming in and out of the gym and seeing these big wads of money being traded, and various fights and arguments between promoters. Sometimes there was fears that these guys would come back with guns and start shooting up the gym. It was then that I realized that something was amiss.
Now, you were a Farang. Is that the right way to put
it? Yeah. A foreigner of Western descent. It's derived from the Thai word for French, Farangset.
So how were the Farang regarded in the Rompo gym?
Well, very marketable. Because Thais love to see their boys fighting foreigners and they love to see their boys beating foreigners. However, times are changing. A lot of Westerners who were turning up at Rompo Gym and various other gyms in Thailand, like in Bangkok, like Jitties, for instance, these guys were very adept. They had very good hands. They were very well schooled in the gyms that they came from in the West. So it was a lot more competitive and not as easier for the Thais as they thought it would be.
You describe this kind of gym living on the margins. Describe this scene for us at an actual fight. Who's there? What does it look like? How many people?
There are thousands of people just baying and screaming and shouting. And you have to totally zone out and focus just totally on yourself. And when you're actually walking into the ring, it's very difficult to screen all of that out. Because if you don't, you're going to lose and you're going to be unhinged. And then when, of course, you climb into the ring and you're facing the other guy, you've got all of the people around the ring screaming and shouting at you. And it's actually very unnerving to see people contorted like that and baying for your blood.
And you were put in the ring with several Thai fighters and other Farangs. Did you fight differently than you had learned back home?
Yeah, certainly my game got better. I got a lot more powerful and my kicking improved and my knees improved. And also I was able to use my elbows, and I've got very sharp elbows, and I wasn't allowed to use those when I was fighting in the West, in the UK, for instance. You weren't allowed to elbow to the head, but you were allowed to knee to the body.
There are officials and regulations here in the US. Any kind of governance there in Thailand?
Well, there wasn't any drug testing in the sport, which shocked me. And also what shocked me as well was going to the local chemist and discovering that I could buy any steroid that I wanted over the counter, no questions asked. So that would help some fighters. They would take clenbuterol if they needed to lose weight quickly, or if they needed to bump up a weight, if they were moving from, say, light heavyweight to super heavyweight, they would take something like HGH or nandrolone and they could bump up the weight, no problem.
You actually were faced with having to lose a lot of weight before a fight. Tell us about the circumstances that set that up.
Yeah, losing weight is really difficult. And I turned professional in my 30s. I was 35 years old. And when I turned up at the gym, I was over my fight weight. So I had to lose, I lost in total about 40 pounds in weight. And a lot of that I'd accrued from things like weightlifting and drinking beer and stuff like that and not watching my diet. Mm-hmm. So I lost a lot of strength going down, and it was having to find a sort of happy medium within which to work. So because you cannot lose the weight too quickly, but quite often promoters would ask you to lose the weight very quickly for you to make fights.
Well, they asked you to lose weight very quickly and then set you in the ring with somebody who was 20 pounds heavier.
Yeah, that happened quite a lot. That actually happened to me once. I was fighting a guy who was 10 pounds heavier, and I lost the fight. There was no Rocky-style comeback victory for me on that. But that was a setup that was quite common. And that's when you realize that the whole thing is a fix. The sport only really exists for gambling, and you're just a non-durable commodity. And at the end of the day, it's a revolving door. One guy's going to come in and another guy's going to go out. And also the life of a lot of these Nakmuis, especially the indigenous people, the Thais, there was a lot of child exploitation. A lot of children were sold off to gyms as indentured servants. They wouldn't earn any money and they would have to fight to live. And that was actually quite sickening to see that. It nauseated me and it sort of opened up my eyes. You know, when you see a small child at no more than 11 years old whipped with a skipping rope for refusing to train, you can't close your eyes to it.
Yeah, that's a terrible picture. But for you, the other fighters, did they make money? Did you make money?
No, the most money I ever made from one bout was about $500. But I wasn't really in it for the money. I mean, I've always been in it for the love of the sport, but also the love of the art. And I think the love of the art transcends the organized sport. And now that I'm getting older now, I've been a Nakmuai for 25 years. I'm 44 now. I'm easing down.
So the promoters are making money largely from gambling. Fighters not making that much money. Is betting on fights legal in Thailand?
Not high scale betting, but betting. Gambling is technically illegal, like prostitution is technically illegal, but it still goes on. Mm-hmm. And if you go to Lumpini or Ratchathamnern Stadium in Bangkok, you will see the furious betting that goes on around the ring. And you can't say that it's illegal or it doesn't exist because it's going on all around you, but it's just not acknowledged. And there's a lot of kickbacks and there's a lot of interest to keep it that way.
Did the promoters treat the Farangs, the foreigners and the Thai boxers differently?
Yes, they were slightly more respectful to the Westerners because they automatically thought the Westerners were wealthier and they didn't know where they were coming from or whom they knew. I mean, I never really got messed around by our first promoter, Mr. Peck, or indeed our second promoter, Mr. Kanda. I think because of the official connections I had through my wife. So that also made me a bit of a novelty in the gym. Also, I could speak Thai, so I could understand what was going on around me. So that gave me an advantage.
Well, I looked at some films of some of these fights from the Rompo Gym and other places. There's a Russian documentary. They are brutal. Do you think you've had any residual effects?
Yeah, every guy carries an injury around with them. I mean, I've injured pretty much every part of my body, both my knees, my legs, my back, my eyes. And it catches up with you. And you have to know when to draw out of the game because you can sustain permanent damage. And you don't have any, you know, rather like these student athletes here who are exploited, you don't have any workman's comp or anything like that. And it's very hard to get insurance for that. I mean, at the moment, I'm getting my teeth fixed, and that's all down to the fights that I had.
Well, Alexander Reynolds, you be careful out there, and thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Alexander Reynolds is a writer and journalist based in the UK. His article for Vice, The Seedy Underworld of Muay Thai Boxing, along with some videos from the notorious Rompo Gym, are on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Up next on Word of Mouth, the filmmaker asks a provocative question. Can a real, productive conversation happen if the privileged majority can't even name what it means to be white? We're going to learn about the Whiteness Project. After the news, when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. What does it mean to be white? That question is rarely asked in any kind of direct way in America. Filmmaker Whitney Dow has found that white people don't feel comfortable talking about whiteness, which he thinks is an essential part of our national conversation about racial identity, culture, and privilege. So Dow has set out to ask 1,000 white people that very question. What does it mean to be white? Even if the answers might be uncomfortable.
Do I think it's beneficial for me to be white? Have I gotten any privileges like that? I would say no.
I don't really think I've ever come across anything that has made me aware of my race.
I do not feel a specific common bond with white people. If you were going to ask me, do I feel a common bond with Jewish people, then the answer would absolutely be yes.
I don't know any people that aren't proud of that they're white, you know, not in my social group.
Those are excerpts from the first installment of the Whiteness Project. It's a multimedia project from POV. At first blush, defining whiteness sounds like thinly veiled white supremacist propaganda. But dig a little deeper, and you'll find that creator Whitney Dow has a long track record for tackling race in complex ways. He and his African-American producing partner Marco Williams, for example, documented the aftermath of a modern-day lynching for the Peabody Award-winning documentary Two Towns of Jasper. To get candid reactions with the townspeople of Jasper, they deliberately segregated their film crew into black and white. Dow's the sort of filmmaker accustomed to sparking controversy and discussion, which is certainly the case for the Whiteness Project. And Whitney Dow, happy to speak with you on Word of Mouth.
Well, thank you for having me on.
So what made you want to do a project like this? Pretty volatile, potentially.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, I'm glad that you brought up Two Towns of Jasper, my work with Marco, because it's actually the DNA for this project came out of Jasper and the work I've been doing with Marco over the last 18 years, is that I found that as we were doing projects, they tended to be oppositional constructs, meaning, you know, something where white people were doing something horrible to non-white people or something historical that had happened that was bad. And it kind of, I felt it did two things. One, it kind of took everyday white people who weren't out, you know, doing horrible things off the hook because it allowed them to think that race and racism was something outside of themselves. Mm-hmm. When you're having a conversation across race, you're talking about commonalities and you're not really examining yourself. And I really felt like after a while that if I was interested in changing the dynamic of the race dynamic in this country, I had to look at my own community and understand my own race in order to have a productive conversation.
Well, you plan to do 1,000 interviews. So far, you've posted 21 from Buffalo, New York. Some very thought-provoking answers. Others, I have to say, kind of cringeworthy, but all seemingly very candid. So here, we're going to play another clip from one of the interviews. This is conducted for the Whiteness Project.
There is one black man of prominence in the department, of a department of, I'd say, 50 or so people closely that I work close to. And so I think, okay, well, do I just roll in a line of work that attracts white guys, primarily like myself? Or is there something going on that they won't hire people of color? I don't know. It really troubles me. And then I think, well, okay, I am social. I go out. I go downtown. I play games with friends. I'm very socially active. Why do I not hang around with or see, or why am I only primarily around white people?
So this man seems to be asking himself, am I subconsciously racist? I mean, was this a common viewpoint from people that you spoke to?
You know, I loved that interview with Rob, and I thought it was really interesting because he kind of reflects, I think, the viewpoint of a lot of people like myself. I mean, I have a very diverse professional life. You know, sometimes I'm the only, like, straight white male in the office. But when I look at my personal circle, my personal life, it is very monochromatic, and it is troubling to me, and I asked why that is. And I think that that's something that people who view themselves as open-minded and view themselves as progressive and view themselves as just are struggling with. How come, if this is the case, how come in our private spaces we tend still to be so segregated?
We do hear and learn from the Whiteness Project a number of statistics. One saying 75% of white people say that their social networks are predominantly white. Let's see, 72% of people identify as white alone. So, you know, like not French American or Italian or Polish, just white. These are people who, we get the picture, are not used to talking about race. So how did you first get people to agree to speak and get them to speak so openly on a subject that a lot of people avoid?
We cast a pretty wide net, and we used we walked around neighborhoods and talked to people, went to bars. We used personal networks of people, some of the people that were on the crew in Buffalo. And I think that what happens is that people who agree to participate in a project like this have something to say. They want to. They want to. The people who don't want to talk to you don't come down. And the other thing is that the way I run the interviews are pretty straightforward. I tell people, we're going to be talking about race. If you don't like this, the interview, anything you've said, don't sign the release till after we're done. And so I'm pretty open with people about what I'm up to. But I also think that people are really interested in having this discussion. And I think white people are really interested in having this discussion. And you say they don't talk about race. I disagree. White people talk about race all the time. They just don't talk about their own race. Mm-hmm. And I think they're often in the conversation as talking about race as something other than themselves. But they do get uncomfortable. And I think that a lot of times when you say it's cringeworthy, is that white people aren't used to talking about their race as a dynamic force in their lives. And so they do say some things that, as they're sort of finding their way through the subject matter, they are going to say some things that perhaps don't sound so considered.
Hmm. Well, let's hear another clip from the Whiteness Project.
I think that, you know, with civil rights and everything, I think a lot of times that other minorities sometimes get more benefits than I would as being a white person. For some reason, some black people kind of hold on to the back in the day, the slave thing, or they feel they're not being treated right. Should slavery be something that, because it happened, we owe black people something more? Absolutely not. Like I said, it had nothing to do with me. It had nothing to do with black people living today.
Okay, so I'm going to call that a little cringeworthy. You know, for some reason, black people are upset about this whole slavery thing?
Well, again, what I say is that when people aren't used to talking about it, they do perhaps not know how to put things the best way. But I think that what Jason says there is something that a lot of white people are grappling with, despite in the terms that he puts it, is that do we owe black people something as white Americans? Everybody will agree that the history of American institutionalized racism and that, you know, that sort of not only was this country built on, but then was, you know, exist in this country for so long. And so what are our obligations, if any? And that's, you know, I think the data point after that is I think it's that one says 3% of white Americans think we should give reparations. Mm-hmm. So it is something that people are thinking about and grappling with. And even though it sounds – if 3% think we owe black people something, what he's saying is not something that is not a widely held thought. These are things that I've heard from people in, you know, the almost 20 years I've been doing this. And I really wanted to have things that people said be representational of things that were out there. And the data points are really to show, look, this isn't just Whitney's opinion. This is the reality. If you go to the census and you do any sort of like modicum of a search on it, all this information is out there. The other thing that I think is really interesting is the relationship between the quantitative and the qualitative. And what I mean by that is that the qualitative emotional experience of someone like Jason living in the world and the actual quantitative reality, as shown in some of the data points, of what the benefits are of being white in this country.
Mm-hmm. Well, I understand the desire to surface these things. And it's, you know, it obviously started a really interesting conversation just looking at some of the comments on the Whiteness Project. But do you worry at all that somebody might come to your website, listen for the first time, and write the whole thing off as a kind of form of racism or even PC racism?
Yeah, and absolutely, and I think that's happened on both fronts. And I get a lot of email about this project, and you know, I think that early on, before people really spent time with it, there was sort of this immediate reaction against it, sort of this visceral reaction against it. But I think that once people spent time with it, and as you said at the beginning, A, it had POV's name on it, and POV and Marco and I have a long relationship. We did, you know, Two Towns of Jasper with them. And then they looked at my track record of what I've been doing, and they said, well, this is something we have to consider. And what I've been interesting is that as the site's been up, people have been spending longer and longer and longer on it. So when it first came up, people were looking at it, doing a couple of things, having a reaction and mm-hmm. leaving. Mm-hmm. And now people are – I think they're spending like an average of 7 or 8 minutes on it, which is for a website is – you know, that means they're watching 7 or 8 of these videos is phenomenal. You know, I think part of having this conversation is being open to other people's point of view and being, you know, generous in how you're listening. And if somebody doesn't want to listen to what I have to say, I can't control that.
Let's hear another clip from one of the women that you interviewed for the Whiteness Project.
If you sit around with anyone, you know, they talk about how they're Italian or Polish or French or German, and it's a great source of pride. Very rarely have I ever heard anyone say, I'm white. Like, I think I would be thrown if I got that as an answer. I'd be like, yeah, that's great. And what else are you? In my mind, it's really just that box. It's checking that box on the government form because literally that's the only time I consider myself that. After that, it's strictly I think of myself in an ethnic way.
That was one of several clips of an interview conducted by the Whiteness Project. It's a multimedia documentary by filmmaker Whitney Dow, who's with us now, which asked white people to share their views on what it means to be white. And she is raising a really interesting notion, you know, this kind of idea of whiteness as a kind of lack of identity. You know, I think so often in American society, people define culture or ethnicity as other than white. What's going on here?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. And that's one of the real motivations, the origin story of this project is me having experience where despite all my work on race with Marco, despite the films I had made, I hadn't really understood my race as sort of this active, dynamic component of my life. And that she says, when she says, you know, it's the only time I ever think of myself that way. But you know what? That's not that, you know, you have to understand that other people perceive you that way. You may not think of yourself that way. And I used to think, oh, well, you know, my whiteness is secondary to my individuality. And I've had a lot of experiences doing the work I've done where that's just been shown I've completely false, where that my identity as a white male is such a powerful sort of antecedent to people interacting with me that it actually supersedes my individual personality, my individuality. And I think that's a very scary thing for, I think, white Americans who haven't had to think about their race as this sort of force in their lives.
These interviews were conducted in Buffalo in July anyway, before Ferguson, mm-hmm. Missouri blew up over the killing of an unarmed black man. Now, a lot of conversations followed that, saying, you know, we've got to talk about race in America. And this project, of course, preceded that. Is the Whiteness Project stirring a multiracial conversation, do you think, or is it being viewed primarily by a white audience?
I think it's a multiracial, and I have to be honest, I didn't set out to make a multiracial conversation. I kind of had this attitude, look, if white people are going to participate in this, they have to deal with some of their own stuff first. But what's been interesting is the feedback I've gotten from people of color, from, you know, all across the political spectrum, saying how interesting and cathartic it was to see white people grapple with race. And also, one of the things I'm sure you notice when you watch it is that when people are asked about whiteness, white people ask about whiteness, they tend to talk about black people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think
it's always defining as not black.
Right. But I also have heard from, you know, a number of African-American people in it that, you know, it's kind of parallels their experience where they feel that their blackness is defined by the whiteness of America. And it's interesting for them to see whites kind of grapple with the same thing.
So as you go across the country, do you think that the tenor of the conversation will change?
I think that it absolutely will. That if I go to, you know, the rural South, or I go to, you know, parts of the country that are very diverse, or parts of the country that aren't very diverse, places like Iowa, you're going to get very different types of reactions. But I also believe there will be some constants, and I think this constant of white people grappling with their whiteness is something that will be a constant throughout all the interviews.
Whitney Dow, thank you.
Thank you.
Whitney Dow is one of the filmmakers behind the Peabody Award-winning film Two Towns of Jasper. He is currently at work on The Whiteness Project. It's a multimedia documentary that explores the meaning of whiteness in America. And you can watch these tightly edited interviews from the project. There's a link at wordofmouthradio.org. And we're anxious to know what you think. Does the whole concept of whites talking about whiteness strike you as indulgent? Does it rub you the wrong way? Or do you think, as awkward as it may be, it is an essential part of understanding race in America? Would you feel comfortable talking openly about your own race? Do you think we're better off discussing commonalities rather than the differences? To make this a bigger conversation, we need to hear from you. So please share your thoughts on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth on NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Over the past few years, the Washington Redskins have been embroiled in a series of battles over its team's name. Many object to the name for evoking the abject racism of a bygone era. But before engaging in the debate, it may help to understand the origins of the word Redskin and how it came to be seen as offensive. As Lauren Ober reports, the word's genesis might come as a surprise.
This is an origin story in three parts. Part one, the word.
The word itself is a Native American tradition.
That's Ives Goddard, a senior linguist at the National Museum of Natural History here in the district. In 2005, he wrote an exhaustive paper charting the etymology of the word redskin.
Its emergence and use in Indian languages and in English has to be understood within the historical context.
That context, he says, was this. Before Europeans arrived on the new continent, Native people had no word for their race. You were Apache or Ojibwe, Salish or Seneca. There was no need for any self-designation beyond that. Then the Europeans landed. Native people needed a way to differentiate the two groups, and color designation seemed like the easiest shorthand.
The use of red for Indians appears in 1725 in two different places, in a French source and an English source, in talks between Indian chiefs and colonial officials. And it's what the Indians use.
Goddard should know. He's been studying Native American languages his entire professional life. He speaks lots of them, and when he heard claims in the early 1990s that the word redskin was derived from the practice of scalping Indians for a bounty, he balked. A manuscript written in 1815 by Meskwaki chief Black Thunder in his own language backed Goddard up.
A word Meshkin Namashkat means redskin. And in fact, in the same sentence, Wapeshkin Namashkat, which means white skin, which is a word that's still used today. The word that's literally white skin in Meskwaki is still the word for European.
Still, Goddard accepts that while the word redskin has native origins, the way we view words and the way we appropriate and reinterpret them can change over time.
Ethnic labels can rise and fall in acceptability and so forth. We all know famous examples. Some words you can't even say on the air anymore, which 100 years ago was just kind of normal for many people.
One of those ethnic labels ended up becoming a big part of Washington's cultural landscape. And that brings us to part two of our story, the team.
The organization started in 1932 in Boston. They were known as the Boston Braves, their very first season of existence.
Mike Richman is the author of the Redskins Encyclopedia. He bills himself as the premier historian of the team.
They had been founded by a man named George Preston Marshall, and then the following year they became the Redskins, Boston Redskins, and stayed in Boston for a total of 5 seasons and then moved to Washington in 1937.
Back in the day, it was common for professional baseball and football teams from the same city to have the same or at least similar names. In 1933, Boston's football team began playing in Fenway Park, home to the Boston Red Sox. George Marshall decided the team name should reflect the move.
He kept red from Red Sox, and he also wanted to keep that Native American theme.
So Marshall went with the name Redskins. Legend also has it that Marshall wanted to honor the team's coach at the time, Lone Star Dietz, who claimed to be Sioux. Plus, the team had some Native players, so in Marshall's mind, the name made sense.
Marshall was a visionary, and my sense is when he saw the opportunity to capitalize on that Native American connection, he went for it.
As such, in the early days, the team's coach wore a headdress on the sidelines, and its players covered their faces in war paint. George Marshall also installed a marching band that played the team's fight song, Hail to the Redskins.
Back then, it was acceptable. And in none of my research that I've done have I ever come across anything that said he tried to exploit Native Americans.
Richman may not feel the Redskins' name is exploitative, but that's far from a universal belief. Which leads us to part three of this story, the controversy.
The first objections really date from the late 50s and early 60s. And they're only incidentally focused on sports.
So says J. Gordon Hilton, a visiting professor at the University of Virginia School of Law. In 2010, he wrote a Law Review article about the use of Native American team names.
The sort of initial wave of complaints is about the disparaging way in which Native Americans are portrayed in Hollywood films.
The representation of Native Americans as savage marauders pillaging wagon trains on the plains didn't sit well. But it wasn't until the 1980s that people began to make noise about Native team names.
Once people began to complain about the depiction of Plains Indians, that this is unfair and this is racist and it's highly prejudicial, then I think that also adds to the sort of pejorative character.
For a long time, Native Americans have been seen as a public domain symbol for Anglo-Americans, not unlike, say, the bald eagle. But many Native people, like Suzanne Schoen Harjo, a Cheyenne and Muskogee activist, didn't appreciate being an abstract motif in American popular culture. In 1992, Harjo and 7 other Native plaintiffs filed a complaint with the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office against the Redskins, claiming that the team name was disparaging and should be deregistered.
This would not keep the Redskins from using the name, but it would deny them the kind of economic advantages of having a protected trademark.
That case fizzled on a technicality, but a new case is now being heard by the Trademark Trial and Appeal Board. Harjo spoke about the issue with WAMU last year.
They can call themselves any old racist thing they want. The issue before the court is whether the federal government should subsidize with the exclusive right of making money that racism. And we think not.
As the debate over the team's name continues, the controversy has raised some critical issues. Who owns language and who has the right to use it? And at what point can language be considered cultural property? There are no easy answers. But knowing the origins of the word in question is a first step. I'm Lauren Ober.
Well, that does it for today's show. Thank you so much for your listening time. And we would really like to hear from you on some of the issues raised during our conversation about the Whiteness Project. Does it rub you the wrong way to talk about what it means to be white? Or do you think, as awkward as it may be, it is essential to understand race in America? Would you feel comfortable talking openly about your own race? Do you think we're better off discussing commonalities than differences? Share your thoughts on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio, or send us a tweet. I'm Virginia Prescott, back with more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.